Football Weekly is on the air.
This is Wayne Larrivee with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush, and the Pro Football Weekly staff. Welcome to an in-depth look at professional football. Coming up, quarterbacks on the carousel of the NFL offseason.
Yeah, how much has Carson Palmer got left for the Cardinals? Can Matt Flynn be the future with the Raiders? And Nnamdi Asamoah, is he the steal of the offseason for the San Francisco 49ers?
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
The Way We Hear It features news and information gathered by the editors and reporters of Pro Football Weekly, and with us in studio is publisher Hub Arkush and associate editor Arthur Arkush. Quarterback trades and transactions have highlighted this week in the NFL offseason. And guys, let's start with the Seattle Seahawks in the news again. They ship Matt Flynn to the Oakland Raiders for draft picks. A fifth-round pick in 2014, conditional pick in 2015 will go to Seattle. Flynn signed a three-year $26 million deal with the Seahawks in last year's free agency period, then was beaten out for the top job by rookie Russell Wilson. Thus, with the kind of base salary he had, Hub, as you and I talked off the air, they had to make a move trading Flynn. There's no question about that. What do you hear from Oakland in terms of the Raiders and either sweetening the deal or lengthening the deal with Flynn?
Well, I think clearly the Raiders would like to get a longer-term deal, if nothing else, for salary cap purposes, but that's one of the reasons that Seattle had to move Matt Flynn. They are now completely committed to Russ Wilson, and I guess you'd have to argue with the results last year that they should be, and yet Flynn was going to count five and a half. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. His base salary in this year was going to be $5.5 million, plus there was probably some of that bonus prorated, so there was no way that Seattle could have a backup quarterback eating $6, $7 million in cap space. Now, once he moves to the Raiders, I believe the bonus portion of it prorates against the Seattle cap, but the Raiders still want to get some lower bases on him. The more important issue here is that Reggie McKenzie was in Green Bay when Matt Flynn was drafted out of LSU. He's a guy who obviously feels he knows what kind of quarterback he's getting. Flynn is much younger than a Carson Palmer or some of these other guys who have moved, and so I think the Raiders think, or at least hope, that he's their guy of the future. So we're going to talk a little bit further on about what this does to the draft and teams still in need of quarterbacks, but I think you can take the Raiders off that list now. You know, they've got Terrell Pryor, who they said they were going to let compete at the position. I don't think he can, but if they were going to let him compete, they must think maybe he can play quarterback in the NFL, so he becomes the backup, and the Raiders made this move because they feel that they've solved their quarterback problems.
You know, when you look at the flip side of that, obviously the Raiders had a quarterback in Carson Palmer. Now he's an Arizona Cardinal for conditional seventh-round 2014 pick and swapping one of their sixth-round picks this year for Oakland's seventh-round selection. Arthur, tell us a little bit about this. Now, Palmer apparently redid his deal in Arizona to fit under their cap, but wouldn't have done it in Oakland.
That's right. Yeah, he was definitely wanting to force his way out. This isn't the first time we've seen this with Palmer, who, of course, just refused to play in Cincinnati and made that trade happen to Oakland. So, you know, what we can tell you is, yes, he did make the deal more cap-friendly for the Cardinals. We can also tell you that on paper, he's a great fit in Bruce Arians' vertical offense. Carson Palmer long been known to have one of the better deep arms in the NFL. So I think that's a natural fit there that definitely could work. The question is, you know, how much does he have left in the tank, obviously? And we're going to have to wait and find out. It's been kind of dicey the past 2 years in Oakland, but he didn't have much around him, obviously, offensive line. Now he's entering another situation where the protection could be an issue. One thing he certainly didn't have in Oakland was Larry Fitzgerald, so that's going to make him look good regardless of, you know, what he has left in the tank.
Well, you know, guys, I think what certainly Carson Palmer would argue for you is you go back 2 years to that first year in Oakland, he threw for 4,000 yards. He had a 14-6 touchdown interception ratio with a bad football team, although they did get almost to 500 that year, and that was, you know, with Hugh Jackson making the huge commitment. Hugh Jackson, of course, his background prior to being a head coach, an offensive coach, a quarterback coach, and with the change in coaching regimes, with all the talent that's been shipped out of town to make up for the salary cap nightmare that Al Davis left behind, apparently Palmer just felt that there was no future in Oakland, but he obviously still believes he can play. And you look at, you know, what Arizona has done. They've got Larry Fitzgerald there to work with him. I think the Cardinals will still draft a young quarterback, but they immediately cut John Skelton, so that tells you that you know, this is Palmer's job to keep for as long as he can keep it.
And, of course, Kevin Cobb, former quarterback of the Arizona Cardinals, now moves on to Buffalo, two-year deal in free agency. Arthur, does he fit what they want to do in Buffalo?
Yeah, I think he could be a good fit. The one thing I would caution anyone who thinks that Kevin Cobb is suddenly the answer is, as I still expect Doug Marrone to go out and get a quarterback for sure. He now has Cobb and Jackson both competing for that starting job. Neither one of those guys has panned out in, you know, in that particular role during their short career. So I think more than anything what it does is it gives a new coach and a new regime some more options and, you know, gives them a little bit more flexibility as we head into the draft and a quarterback class that obviously leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, and the thing there, guys, when you look at Buffalo, though, both of these guys have been, well, not the future, but some people had hoped the future. Tavares Jackson first in Minnesota, then remember Seattle traded for him. Now he's, you know, he's moved on again to Buffalo. As a matter of fact, the Bills traded for him last year. Kevin Cobb, the Cardinals gave up a second round draft pick for him to the Eagles and a Pro Bowl cornerback in Antonio Rodgers Cromartie. So, you know, I think the difference between the two is that Cobb at least was given a chance to take a job and keep it in Arizona. And I'm not so sure that injuries weren't the bigger problem than his production on the field. Jackson, for whatever reason, I don't think has ever been given more than 9, 10, 12 starts in a row. Remember the year before Brett Favre got to Minnesota, Tavares Jackson took the Vikings to the playoffs, and they lost in the first round. So, you know, are these franchise quarterbacks? Is this something for Vikings fans to be excited about? No, it's not. But now you have to wonder, does Doug Marrone think he can get his kid from Syracuse, Nassib, in the second round? I mean, it really seems unlikely to me with Jackson and Cobb competing at least to start this year that they're going to reach for anybody at number 8 in the first round. So unless the best quarterback out there available is there, I don't know if Buffalo's going to make a move there.
Meanwhile, guys, if you're wondering why teams are going to pay people like Aaron Rodgers $22-plus million a season, this carousel of quarterbacks that we are seeing, many of whom, as Hub mentioned, were targeted to be the franchise and the future quarterback of that team, are spinning on this carousel like it's nobody's business. And, you know, quarterback play, if you've got a franchise guy, there is no cost that's out of whack with how much you have to pay to keep him. We'll be back with details on the 49ers' moves and Tony Romo when Pro Football Weekly continues. Welcome back to this NFL free agency edition of Pro Football Weekly, featuring the publisher and editor, Hub Arkush, and associate editor, Arthur Arkush. Well, a lot happening, as we've been mentioning. In the first segment, we talked about quarterback moves. There was another quarterback move, but it was a move to sign a quarterback and keep him in town. Tony Romo and the Dallas Cowboys came to agreement on a 6-year extension, $108 million. Arthur, $55 million in guaranteed money. Romo hasn't won a Super Bowl, but when you talk about Romo's numbers compared to the quarterbacks we just discussed in the last segment, you can understand why Dallas stepped up here.
Yeah, I think so. And it kind of just to go off what you said, Wayne, it's just such an inexact science with these guys and obviously the most important position in football, maybe professional sports. So, you know, I can't blame the Cowboys for doing what they did. I don't know if Tony Romo is going to take them to a Super Bowl or not, but I think it's as much about what else is not out there and really the fact that their hands were tied, much like the Ravens' hands were tied. Of course, Flacco got the Super Bowl ring, was just absolutely marvelous in the postseason. I think that performance obviously drove up his price. It kind of backed the Ravens into a corner. Even without that Super Bowl, the Cowboys found themselves in that same corner and they had to pull the trigger.
You know what's interesting here, though, guys, and this is where you really have to take a closer look at these contracts. For all practical purposes, that, you know, people or agents, I should say, would like you to believe that Flacco got $15 million more than Romo did, and one's a 6-year $120 million, the other's a 5-year $105 million. But the reality is that Romo got a couple million more guaranteed than Flacco did. And that's the way it should be. I think he got $3 million more guaranteed, 55 versus 52. And we can talk all we want about Tony Romo not winning big games, but the bottom line is that he's got a significant winning percentage for the Dallas Cowboys, and his passer efficiency makes him the fifth most efficient passer in the history of the game. Mm-hmm. That's rated against everybody. So, you know, you wonder, is it just something that's waiting to happen? Is it that the talent around him needs to get better, and then they'll win the playoff games or get to a Super Bowl? Or is it Romo's fault? Well, I think now that he's got this contract, Wayne, it's going to be on him if they don't win a playoff game this year.
And Hub, I mean, it's probably, the answer to your question is, you've discussed many times, probably a little bit of both. I mean, Jerry Jones hasn't exactly made hits on all of his draft picks and acquisitions surrounding Tony Romo, so maybe that supporting cast has to get a little bit better. And yeah, maybe Romo has to play better when they're in the playoffs and in that game-winning situation. But nonetheless, I mean, you understand why the Cowboys did what they did.
Yeah, I've said it, and I will continue to stand by it. I think year in and year out, the Cowboys' talent talent is the most overrated in the NFL. Now, that said, they've made some more decent moves this offseason. They've actually been a little more quiet because of their salary cap problems. But if they can fix the offensive line, they're in pretty good shape defensively, particularly with Monty Kiffin there. They need to get some depth at wide receiver. That's probably going to be the biggest challenge for Tony Romo. Is Dez Bryant now does look like a legitimate number one if he keeps his head on straight. Can Miles Austin stay on the field, and who's going to be 3 and 4, and how much longer can Jason Witten be the best tight end in football?
Yeah, they've got some weapons there, no doubt about that. Now, as we tape this program on Thursday of this week, the Green Bay Packers are closing in on a deal with quarterback Aaron Rodgers that would make him the highest paid player in NFL history, further amplifying the premium on franchise quarterbacks in this league.
Well, and it's just got to get done, Wayne. The bottom line is I don't think there's any argument anymore. You know, up until maybe last year, the year before that, you'd throw Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and Aaron Rodgers in a hat, and they're probably still, you know, three MVP candidates. But the fact that Rodgers is 5-6 years younger than those guys and that his best football is still in front of him and he's got the ring, it makes him the most valuable quarterback in football. And what the Packers cannot afford to let happen is let him get anywhere near free agent. Anywhere near the idea that maybe he'd want to find out what else is out there. So now is the time. The market's only going to go up. The salary cap has not grown, and therefore salaries have not increased the way the players hoped they would when they signed this CBA in 2011. But the bottom line is that quarterback money is going up right now because of the Flacco and Romo deals, and now is the time for both sides to get Aaron Rodgers locked in. He's going to end up, I'm going to guess, with $65 to $70 million guaranteed. Nobody's ever gotten that before. He should, and that's a deal you got to make today.
Now, how about his current deal? If I'm not mistaken, he has at least a year, and I believe 2 years left on that current deal, but you're right, they're not going to let him get close to the free agency. Clay Matthews, on the other hand, is coming up into the final year of his rookie contract, and Arthur, again, late reports are the Packers are close to coming to agreement with the deal on Clay Matthews. These are the two major points of emphasis for Green Bay during the offseason, beyond anything that was out there free agency-wise, beyond even signing a Greg Jennings or somebody like that. They had to get these two guys in the fold for the long term.
Yeah, that's right, and I think you can see it, you know, on the field when Clay Matthews is out there, that's a different defense, there's no question about it. It's also worth adding that Aaron Rodgers and Clay Matthews do share an agent, David Dunn, so that could be a bit of a factor here in trying to get both deals done either simultaneously or right around the same time. But when I look at both of these deals, I basically see, you know, you're paying for future production. When in the NFL, you have to be most careful about is paying for what's happened in the past. Obviously, Rodgers and Matthews have already both been dominant at their positions, but they're also both in the peak of their career and should, you know, have plenty of good years left. That's why you just can't risk letting them get away.
Great points, Arthur, no doubt about it. Let's move on to something else besides quarterbacks, although that is the dominant topic of the NFL in the offseason. Former Philadelphia Eagle All-Pro cornerback Nnamdi Asamoah. Hobby goes, this is the guy who 2 years ago was just, I mean, he was the end-all be-all outside of Revis Island at cornerback in the National Football League. Eagles brought him in, part of Dream Team. He's been let go, and now he signs a one-year deal with the 49ers. Did they get him cheap enough?
They really did. I mean, the base package is rumored to be about $1.35 or $1.4 million. The incentives could take it up to $3 million. But this is an interesting situation because 2 years ago he went to Philly for $60 million, of which, as I recall, $28 million was guaranteed. And guaranteed is guaranteed. So the 49ers are now playing on the Eagles' dime, so to speak. You know, and they're getting a tremendous bargain here. Now, he was not as productive in Philadelphia as he was in Oakland, but a lot of that was the style that the Eagles played. What the Niners are going to do is create tremendous pressure in front of him with huge hitters at safety and really play to Asamoah's strengths. And you've got the veteran Carlos Rogers on the other side. I think that he's going to have a return to his Pro Bowl form. And like everything else the Niners have touched in the last couple years, this appears to be a brilliant signing.
Niners also got some competition for backup quarterback by acquiring Colt McCoy from Cleveland. We'll have more news and notes when Pro Football Weekly returns. Welcome back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrabee along with Hub Arkish, Arthur Arkish, our associate editors with us as well. The NFL draft is coming up in a few weeks, and quarterbacks are always in the news on draft day, but guys, this is not quite what we've seen the last few years. And you know, in terms of quarterbacks coming in and being ready to play in the NFL, you know, Hub, you were mentioning off the air, plenty of teams still have needs at quarterback, but this draft doesn't have guys who you take a look at and say, hey, I think he's almost NFL ready. He can come in and step in and play right away.
Well, and that's going to be the key to this draft, Wayne, because remember at one point last year, we had, I believe it was 11 of the 32 NFL starting quarterbacks were either first or second year players. And when teams drafted a Cam Newton, when teams drafted a Blaine Gabbert in Jacksonville, who's already on the outs there, and certainly last year with Andrew Luck, with Robert Griffin III, with Brandon Weeden because of his age, you were picking these guys to step in and start, if not from day one, certainly by week three, week four, week five. Now, you look at the top quarterbacks this year, and according to Pro Football Weekly, Matt Barkley is the number one prospect on the board. Ryan Nassib out of Syracuse, and of course his coach Doug Marrone is now at Buffalo, so there's a lot of rumors there. E.J. Manuel out of Florida State. We've got all three of those kids with grades between 6.03 and 5.89. So they're literally within a little more than a tenth of a point of each other, which is the margin for error on these rankings altogether. So any one of those three could go in any order, but those are all bottom of the first, top of the second round grades. Then at number four, we got Tyler Wilson of Arkansas. At five, Zach Dysart of Miami of Ohio. And then all the way down at six, Geno Smith of West Virginia. We're going to get to that in the next segment. But you look at the grades on those kids, they've got second, third, fourth round grades. Can a team afford to use a top 10 pick, a top 15 pick on somebody who really shouldn't go until the second or third round?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Now, you know, again, when you look at some of these teams, it's still have need at quarterback, guys. Arthur, you know, Arizona gets Carson Palmer in, but I got to tell you something. He's no sure thing, is he?
No, he's not. He's clearly on the downside of his career. And, you know, Bruce Arians had said he liked Drew Stanton a lot, another guy they brought in. But neither one of these guys are sure things, as you mentioned. And just as a quick aside, I just love Bruce Arians. As soon as he came out and had his first OTA press conference, said he believes his quarterback room is as good as any in the NFL with the addition of Carson Palmer. So I just had to kind of chuckle at that and his brashness added to the NFC West. But no sure thing. However, he did also sort of poo-poo them going at number 7 for a quarterback at this point. I think with offensive line needs and certain areas on defense, I'd be surprised if they did pull the trigger in the first round.
How about the Eagles? Still looking at quarterback to get something maybe down the road for the future at least?
You know, when I think they are, but they kind of like Nick Foles. I mean, you know, they used, I think it was a third round pick on him last year, and some people felt if it wasn't for the inconsistency at Arizona, he could have been a first round type prospect. They've got Mike Vick signed, certainly Chip Kelly, who is not going to be as radical pistol run and shoot as people think as he was at Oregon, but he should know how to use Mike Vick. And just like Arthur said about Arizona, the Philadelphia Eagles, with tremendous needs on the offensive line, do as much to injury as talent last year. They've completely rebuilt their defense to switch to a 3-4. You know, they love their wide receivers, but they're really fragile there in DeSean Jackson and Jeremy Maclin. So this is a team with a lot of needs. And I actually put together this list before we started the show, which includes the Arizona Cardinals, Philadelphia Eagles, and then throw in the Buffalo Bills, the Jets, Cleveland, Jacksonville. These are all teams that need a quarterback of the future. There's no question about that. But I think Philly's got their starter this year, and with all their other needs, can they afford to use a first-round pick or a high-round pick on a quarterback who's not going to play for a couple of years?
You know, one team that did go high for a quarterback recently was Jacksonville. They took Blaine Gabbert. How do they feel about him, Arthur?
You know, they're going to give him a chance to compete. Obviously, they have a whole new regime with Dave Caldwell and Gus Bradley coming in. So they've said that they are going to have a competition between Henny and Gabbert. Gabbert has not fared well. That's probably putting it lightly. Henny made the offense at least look like an NFL offense after he stepped into the starting lineup. His numbers weren't great. So those two are certainly going to compete. That kind of gets back to a couple years ago when you're talking about the guys who you expected to start right away. Well, you'd have to say that maybe Jack Del Rio sort of jumped the gun on that a little bit because, of course, Gabbert was coming from the shotgun heavy spread offense. So it just gets back to how many of these guys are ready to play now. And I think we've all agreed that there's really not many in this class.
You know, Wayne, of all these teams, I look at Cleveland. They've signed Jason Campbell, who I think is probably better than 6-7 of the guys who started last year. They used a first round pick last year on Brandon Weeden. Jets have got Mark Sanchez. We talked about Buffalo with the veterans, Tavarius Jackson and Kevin Cobb. They might all need quarterbacks of the future, but Jacksonville, as far as drafting somebody high, that's the team to watch for this reason. Geno Smith is gone. Jack Del Rio is gone. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got no investment in these quarterbacks by Caldwell or by Bradley. So at least, and they're doing a completely rebuilding program. So they're the one team that maybe goes really high and they bet on the athleticism of a Geno Smith, or they go for a Matt Barkley because they say we got to develop our guy of the future and we're rebuilding the whole thing.
All right, stay tuned. We've got that controversial Geno Smith scouting report to dissect for you when Pro Football Weekly returns. Welcome back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly, along with the publisher and editor, Hub Arkush, and associate editor, Arthur Arkush. I'm Wayne Larrabee. Well, this week, fellas, Pro Football Weekly's draft expert and the author of the 2013 NFL Draft Preview book provided by Pro Football Weekly, which is kind of the Bible in many respects for those who follow the NFL draft, a scathing report written by Nolan Araki on Geno Smith, the West Virginia quarterback. And, you know, Hub, I wonder if you can kind of, it's created a little bit of a firestorm, but it's a very similar report, and I have both of them in front of me right here, very similar to what he said about Cam Newton a couple of years ago. And quite frankly, some of the concerns that Newton had, that people had going into the draft on Cam Newton, came to fruition, not so much as in his rookie year, but this past season.
Well, Wayne, the whole idea of this scouting, and we've made a big deal out of the fact that Pro Football Weekly basically created independent scouting of draft prospects going back 40 years ago, is the reason the teams do it and the reason we do it for the fans is to get everybody inside, to get you up to date on who these kids really are and what makes them top 10 prospects, first round prospects, third round prospects, and the physical becomes obvious to a lot of people who've seen him play. The value of the combine, the value of the pro days, the value of the private visits is to get to know them mentally, to understand who they are, how they tick, how they work. The reason scouts dig into the backgrounds of these kids is to understand what might happen when the pressure is on, how they might react to their teammates, what kind of guy they're going to be in the locker room. And Nolan has written that in those categories, Geno Smith didn't do all that well at West Virginia. In a football sense, he doesn't read defense as well. He didn't know how to make his progressions. Look at what happened to him his senior year after the Kansas State game. Bill Snyder was the first coach to really challenge him. They practically shut him out, and he couldn't win again. What was he, 2-4, 2-5 the rest of the way? In their bowl game, he had to play in snow. He fumbled the ball twice. He's got 32 career fumbles. There's a lot of question marks about this kid, but because of some of the big numbers that were put up, everybody just immediately assumes, you know, he's not even the physical prospect that E.J. Manuel is. I mean, if you want to just talk about an athlete and size, E.J. Manuel is the better prospect. So, you know, for those who think that Nolan Araki just goes at a guy every once in a while, go back and read the Cam Newton scouting report from 2 years ago, because for all the firestorm that created, which was more than this one, right now it looks like he was absolutely right. Everybody's asking the questions, can Cam Newton lead a team? Can he be a leader in the locker room? Will he build a winning franchise in Carolina? And as we look at Geno Smith, we hope he has a tremendous NFL career. These are all correctable issues, but this stuff is facts. These are things that were reported by scouts who spent a lot of time with him, by GMs and head coaches that we've talked to who are at the combine, and these are real concerns about Geno Smith that make him no better than the fifth or sixth best quarterback prospect in this draft. He may turn out to be a Hall of Famer, but we're saying as a prospect, there's five kids you'd better be better off risking a high pick on.
You know, guys, another quarterback that makes a lot of headlines because he plays in Los Angeles at USC, and that's Matt Barkley. And last week I was in Los Angeles, and Barkley's workout made front page of the Los Angeles Times sports section, and with a big color picture, the whole bit. It's amazing to me these pro days, these workout days are making a lot of noise. But Arthur, what have you heard on Matt Barkley and his situation? Because he's a kid who was coming off an injury at the end of last year. Now he has this workout. Some said it was pretty good. Some said it was just so-so, that type of thing. What are you hearing?
Well, first and foremost, as we mentioned, he is Pro Football Weekly's top-rated quarterback. We believe he is the most pro-ready to step in from day one. We've already discussed ad nauseum that maybe none of these guys are fully ready, so you have to take that, with a grain of salt. But what we can tell you is that as far as being a system guy, as far as really knowing a playbook, as far as having anticipation and being able to throw with accuracy, at least short to intermediate, he looks every bit the part. He can definitely do those things. He seems to have a good ability to master a playbook, and that's certainly going to appeal to a lot of NFL teams. But if you're looking for a guy with, you know, the sensational athleticism we've seen in the past couple drafts, or someone who can just drill the deep ball, I'm not sure that he's going to be your guy. So it's going to be about fit and whatever team decides that he is going to work in, perhaps a West Coast system, something that's going to do a lot of horizontal passing in addition to vertical, may get themselves a starter for a long time.
One note, he never beat Stanford's pro-style defense in 4 years. That, according to the scouting report by Nolan Naraki and the draft book. And, Hub, you know, when you look at some of these other quarterback prospects, tell me a little bit about Ryan Nassib at Syracuse, because a lot of people think that Doug Marrone, the coach now at Buffalo, may go after him.
You know, kid is 6'2", 227. He runs a 5'40". He's not an athlete. He's not going to be doing a lot of read option, but he's got a really nice arm. He's a tough kid. He's a weight room guy. He's the kind of guy, you know, when you look at some of these questions about, you know, are they going to lead? Are their teammates going to like him? His teammates are going to love him, and he's a kid who has run Doug Marrone's offense. They call it the K-gun at Syracuse, and will do the same if he goes to Buffalo under Nathaniel Hackett, the new offensive coordinator. His senior year, he really started to come on. And here's something that is important with quarterbacks, is we measure their hands, not we. They do it at the combine. And this kid, for a guy 6'2", 227, his hands are 10 and 1/8 inches. You look at E.J. Manuel, another kid I want to talk about, his hands are 10 and 3/8 inches. He's going to be the next prospect on the board after Nassib. After that, we're eventually going to get to, you know, Geno Smith, who we talked about. I said 32 career fumbles. His hands are 9 1/4 inches. He's got these tiny hands. So you look at Nassib, he's got everything you're looking for in an NFL quarterback. He doesn't have quite the athleticism of a couple of these other kids.
Hub, who are they talking about as the next Colin Kaepernick? Because you know they're going to be looking for a guy who's going to run read option for you. You know, that's going to be a prominent thing in this draft.
You know, and the guy with the athletic ability to do it in this group is E.J. Manuel. Some people are talking about Geno Smith, but he doesn't have the size or any more athleticism than Manuel, so look for one of those two kids possibly to get the chance to do it.
Coming up, draft pick running backs previewed when Pro Football Weekly continues after these messages. Welcome back to this off-season edition of Pro Football Weekly, and we continue with a look at the NFL draft and some of the top running backs in the draft. And Hub, I think it was really interesting that we were having this discussion off the air, and that, you know, hey, there were, you could count the number of running backs going in the first round in last year's draft on one hand. This year, there's a possibility that we might not see a running back drafted in the first round. Is that even thinkable?
It is more than thinkable, and there's two things going on here. First of all, we look at these grades. Now, we've got Monte Ball, number one on the board from Wisconsin, with a 5.93 grade. Andre Ellington out of Clemson is number two at 5.90. Then Eddie Lacy out of Alabama at 5.87. Giovanni Bernard is the fourth back. He falls off to 5.75. Usually anything below 5.9 is a second round grade. And so these 5.93, 5.90, this is 25 to 35 territory for Ball and Ellington. It's just a question of how badly a team wants one of these kids. And then when you add the factor that just looking around the NFL, there's just really not a premium on running backs anymore. People think that they can find them anywhere. They find them in free agency, find them in the middle rounds, and it's a very unusual that you'll find a Trent Richardson like last year coming out of Alabama.
Well, and a lot of offenses don't invest enough play calling in the running game to make a high first-round draft choice running back worth taking. But, Arthur, there's an intriguing back that we have, as Hub mentioned, at the top of the list of Pro Football Weekly in terms of draftable running backs, and that's Monte Ball at Wisconsin. You did a story on him recently. Tell us a little bit about this back. As I'm sitting here wondering, okay, he's a heck of a college back. What is he in the pros? Is he a full-time back? Is he a part-time back? Is he a specialist? What is he?
Well, I think he has the makeup to be a three-down back for sure. I mean, he's definitely, has, of course, handled a big workload at Wisconsin. Everyone knows the name because he was one of the more prolific backs in college football history. Has a nose for the end zone. He's a guy who will get the tough yards. He's not a game breaker. He doesn't have that breakaway speed, but he can definitely run in between the tackles. He's got really good hands. So he's got a really good, well-rounded game. And he's a guy who, after his junior season, a lot of people thought was going to leave because he put up just the huge, huge numbers. Decided to return as a senior. Had some off-the-field things happen before the season that, for anything we hear, are not things that NFL teams are going to be concerned about. But he faced quite a bit of adversity between the off-the-field stuff and having two-fifths of his offensive line leave. His offensive line coach got fired in mid-season, so he really overcame a lot. Finished the season very strong, and those are the kind of things that NFL teams are going to, you know, really appreciate. A guy who's shown he can, you know, has that mental toughness.
Hub, when you look at this draft, is there a power back in it? Because, you know, what's working today in the NFL with the lack of tackling and the restrictions on practicing in pads in practice around the NFL now due to the collective bargaining agreement? The power backs, the guys that break tackles, that make things happen. Who would you pick in this draft to be one of those guys?
Yeah, I don't know if these two kids can be. They weren't necessarily in college, but the ones who fit the mold the best, I mentioned Andre Ellington out of Clemson is our second-rated back. We've got Eddie Lacy out of Alabama, number three. Now, this kid is 5'11", 231. He only runs about 4.55, so he is clearly a between-the-tackles banger. Then you got Giovanni Bernard out of North Carolina, and you got Jonathan Franklin out of UCLA. They're not burners, but they're both 4.5, 40 guys. You get to number six, Le'Veon Bell out of Michigan State is a kid a lot of people saw, a lot of people know, 6'1 and 3.8, so 6'1 and a half, 230 pounds. Again, only a 4.57 guy. I saw him get to the edge occasionally at Michigan State, but he's going to make his living between the tackles as well. So I think Lacy and Bell are the two kids you want to keep an eye on there.
Yeah, and you take a look at the running backs, Hub. So much of it now is what can they do in the passing game. Have you seen anyone that stands out there?
Well, you know, none of these kids really were asked to catch in college as much as you would like. Again, that's the big difference in college football right now, where everybody's playing this read option and pistol and run and shoot, where you're not really throwing to your running backs. So you kind of gauge again who seems to have the soft hands, who can handle it. I'll tell you the kid who best fits that mold and who also would be the number one back on this board if it were not for the horrific injuries is Marcus Lattimore out of South Carolina. Now, we know he can catch out of the backfield. He may be the best runner out of the backfield. But as I said, two horrific knee injuries. He's not 100% right now. A lot of our listeners may have heard the story at the South Carolina Pro Day. I think it was about 2 weeks ago. He got a standing ovation from scouts who just couldn't believe he was already doing as much as he is. He will probably be drafted. We've got him with a 5.3 grade on him. If this kid ever gets back to 90 or 95% of what he was at South Carolina, Marcus Lattimore not only will be the best pass-catching running back out of this group, he'll be the best running back out of this group. The question is, can he ever get healthy? Because those were some serious leg injuries.
Coming up, we take a look at some wide receivers for the NFL draft next on Pro Football Weekly. We continue with Pro Football Weekly along with Hub Arkush. I'm Wayne Lara. The Arthur Arkush, our associate editor, has joined us in studio as well. Let's move on to wide receivers. We talked a lot about quarterbacks in the first three segments of this draft. Somebody's got to catch their passes. And so let's talk about wide receivers in this upcoming NFL draft. And Arthur, you know, in the past, obviously size matters at wide receiver, but speed matters, especially at this position. And in this, I guess in this draft class overall, we've got some size, but not as much as we have had in the past. We've got a lot of speed in this class, though, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's accurate, Wayne. I don't think your NFL team's looking for the next Julio Jones or A.J. Green, Demaryius Thomas, some of these big monsters outside the numbers. I don't think there's any sure things in this draft. There's a few intriguing guys we'll talk about. But if you're looking for the shifty, sort of the short area bursts and the guys who can just turn on the jets when they get in the open field, there's definitely a couple intriguing guys. I know that Tavon Austin has definitely turned some heads out of West Virginia. Looks like he's probably going to go somewhere in the first round. Marquise Goodwin out of Texas isn't going to be a first rounder, but he did run a sub 4.3 40 at the scouting combine, which I believe if it wasn't a record, it was right there.
You know, when you look at some of these guys, the kid that jumps out at you is this Tennessee kid, 6'4", Justin Hunter, 196 pounds, ran a 4.4 40. Hub, this guy looks like he's a pretty solid first-round pick.
Yeah, he is. And actually, it's the two Tennessee kids. Justin Hunter should be the first overall wide receiver taken. Cordarrell Patterson was actually more productive at Tennessee, but he doesn't have the length. He's only 6'1 and 7'8", so call it 6'2", but he's 216, so he's 20 pounds bigger and stronger than Justin Hunter and also runs 4.4. As a matter of fact, they're both close to 4.4 flat, and they're both going to be first-round picks. I think that if you want the slightly safer choice, you go with Cordarrell Patterson. If you really are looking to hit the home run and thinking you're not going to completely strike out, you go with Justin Hunter. The difference is Hunter is almost certainly going to be an outside, get down the field, win the jump ball type big play receiver. Patterson can do either. He can go outside, he can go inside. And then in between them, you've got this kid out of Cal, Keenan Allen. He's a little bit lesser known, 6'2", 206. He's only run 4.5 40s. They just didn't have any decent quarterback play at California, so it was really hard to get a gauge on him. But I know the pro scouts, they love his frame. They love his body type. And so I think there's a good chance that all three of these kids, Hunter, Allen, Patterson, all go in the first 25 picks in the draft.
You know, when you look at this Tavion Austin kid out of West Virginia, Arthur, not only could he play wide receiver and get downfield, he's got the speed, but he's also a return specialist, and that's a big help as well.
Yeah, I think so. He's a game breaker in every sense, and we've seen guys in recent years who have been so productive out of the slot with the ability to turn a game on its side here in a hurry. And like you just said, he can do that on special teams. And the question, of course, is as tiny as he is if he's going to be able to stay on the field, and if you're going to have to carve out a super specialized role, or how much work you're going to be able to give him.
Hub, when you look at this overall group of wide receiver, we talked about how running back is this a position that's been, kind of decimated in recent years in terms of big-time talent. At wide receiver, this has been a feature position in recent years, and is this class up to snuff with what we've seen in the past?
Yeah, I think it's a good group. You talk to a lot of scouts, and they'll tell you there is tremendous depth in this group. If you go down, after the four kids we talked about, you look at DeAndre Hopkins out of Clemson, Terrence Williams out of Baylor, get down to Robert Woods at USC. Anybody who saw him play with Matt Barkley has got to be excited about him. That's seven wideouts with pretty solid bottom of the second to middle of the first round grades, and that's about what you're usually going to see. But then you look at these third round grades, Quentin Patton out of Louisiana Tech, Chris Harper from Kansas City State, Stedman Bailey from West Virginia, another West Virginia kid, Aaron Dobson out of Marshall, Marcus Wheaton out of Oregon State. Every one of these kids could easily be a late second to late third round pick. And so you've got some real depth at the position. And then as always, you go looking for the wild card. And the wild card in this group is Denard Robinson, the quarterback out of Michigan. Now, he was not impressive at the combine or at his pro day in terms of understanding the position, in terms of running routes, in terms of knowing, when to high point the football. But he's a 4.240 guy. And, you saw what he does with the football in his hands, tremendous instincts. So he's a kid who is probably going to be overdrafted as a quarterback, as a wide receiver, but he may be underdrafted as almost a Wildcat type quarterback. And if anybody can bring the Wildcat back to the NFL, it'll be Denard Robinson out of Michigan.
I got you. Stay tuned. The Publisher's Pen is coming up next on Pro Football Weekly. The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush. Hub?
Well, Wayne, we've kind of kicked off our pre-draft scouting report talk in earnest in this show, and I want to go back a little bit to something we talked about at the top of segment four. There was a bit of a, I don't want to call it a firestorm, there was a lot of publicity, shall we say, around the country about the Pro Football Weekly / Nolan Naraki scouting report on Geno Smith. And I think it is valuable to remind people, to remind our listeners, to remind fans everywhere, what we're really doing here. These are scouting reports. This is going to as many NFL scouts, NFL coaches, NFL general managers as we can, and finding out what their reaction is to these young men. It's finding out how they do on the psychological testing. It's finding out what happened in their physicals. It's finding out what their real 40-yard dash times are and how strong these kids really are. And more than anything, it's about talking to some of their college coaches and teammates and find out what happened when they were in school. Nobody bats 1,000 in the draft. The teams that we rave about as drafters, you look at the New England Patriots and the San Francisco 49ers and recently Seattle. If they bat 300 or 350, they're having a great day. We're not saying every one of these scouting reports tells you exactly who these kids are. We're trying to tell you these are the concerns that scouts have. These are the things that scouts love when they go to tab these kids in the NFL college draft.
Thanks very much, Hub. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. The coordinating producer and engineer of Pro Football Weekly is Randy Meyer. Pro Football Weekly originates in the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. For Hub Arkush and the Pro Football Weekly staff, this is Wayne Larrabee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week on Pro Football Weekly.